Bible translations, which ones are best? I'm going to talk tonight about the history of English translations. We're going to say a word about the different theories of translation. What are the good criteria for a good translation? And then we're going to answer the $1 million question, which translation of the Bible is best? So hang on, and we'll start with the history of English translations of the Bible. The earliest translations of the Bible go all the way back to the Aramaic. Probably in the late 1st century and early 2nd century, it's known as the Syria Peshitta. It was in Aramaic. Now, Aramaic is the language that Jesus spoke. He probably was bilingual or lingual or trilingual. There was the Koine Greek, which was the general trade language of the day. There was Aramaic, which was the language of the native area of Palestine there, and then he probably knew Hebrew as well. Acts chapter 11 talks about the church there in Antioch, and the Peshitta comes at least from the mid-second century to the early 3rd century. Then at the same time, since it was a Roman Empire, the Bible was early translated about 200 A.D. into Latin, the Old Latin. It was translated from the Greek Old Testament, the Septuagint, known as the LXX or 70. It was widely used in North Africa by Tertullian and Cyprian, who were early fathers. And it was the forerunner of St. Jerome's Latin Vulgate, which was the greatest translation of all time, as we'll see. Also, there was Ethiopic, Coptic, and Arminian translations of the Bible that came out not long after that. And all of those early translations, you remember from a previous discussion, were 19,000 manuscript copies along with the almost 6,000 Greek manuscripts, which totals 25,000 manuscript copies we have from this time period. Then in the Middle Ages, the Latin Vulgate started, 405, St. Jerome, who knew Hebrew, who knew Greek, who lived in Palestine. It is the most long-enduring and influential translation of all time. There's not even a close second. It was the standard Bible of Christendom for over 1,000 years. Now, when you consider that the King James Bible is the most popular Bible of modern times, and it only lasted for 370 years before it was overtaken by the NIV as the most popular translation in the English language, you can see, to have a Bible that lasted for 1,000 years, that's half the whole history of the church, is an incredible Bible. It came from the Latin Vulgate. We get our word vulgar, but the word vulgar is a vulgar distortion of the word for Vulgate. It just means popular language of the day. It was like the universal trade language called Koine Greek, which was also a very common language of the day. St. Jerome translated the entire Bible from the original languages, and Latin was the dominant language not only of Christendom, but later of the universities. In fact, right on up to and through the founding of Harvard University into the 1600s, almost to the 1700s, Latin was still the language of scholars and of universities in America and in Europe. The first modern English translation, which you saw a copy of last week, was the Wycliffe Bible that was put out in 1380. It was translated by hand, and if you saw that, you could hardly tell the difference between printing and by hand. They were so good. Translated by hand from the Latin. He didn't know Hebrew or Greek well enough to translate it, and this was before the printing press, so they had to copy them by hand. People paid a load of hay to read it for one day. A load of hay was a lot of money for a farmer in that day, but if you wanted to read the Bible, you of course couldn't afford a copy made on vellum. It took, you remember, a whole herd of sheep and a year's salary to get a copy of the Bible and a load of hay to just read it for one day. It was later printed, but only in the 18th century after the printing press. It was printed, but Wycliffe's enemies wanted to kill him for doing it, like they wanted to kill the others and succeeded on many of them. But they weren't able to kill him, so what they did was dig up his bones later and put his robes on him, strip him of his priestly robes, and burn his bones posthumously, which I call posthumously. But Wycliffe, nonetheless, suffered the same disgrace. I remember when the RSV was translated, and they burned the translations in Ohio because, as we'll learn later, it had a liberal bend in the Old Testament. One of the translators, Riley, commented, "Well, at least we're making progress. They used to burn the translators. Now they're just burning the translations." So that was great progress. After Wycliffe, the most important person in the history of the translation of the Bible into English was William Tyndale, 1525. Now, just to get a perspective here, Martin Luther tacked up his 95 Theses on the door at Wittenberg in 1517 and started the Reformation. So this is right during the Reformation period. It was condemned by the Roman Catholic Church. So it was produced in Europe and smuggled into England in sacks of flour. Tyndale was burned at the stake. You remember the story, with a rope around his neck, and they tightened it. Fortunately, he probably suffocated first. But he was burned at the stake in 1535. The Bible that most of us use today was due largely to Tyndale. 80% of the King James Bible was adopted lock, stock, and barrel out of Tyndale. So really, the King James Bible we owe to William Tyndale. He was a tremendous Hebrew and Greek scholar, a tremendous linguist, and was the greatest of all the early translators of the Bible. The Coverdale Bible, Miles Coverdale, was an assistant to Tyndale. Many of the other Bibles of this time spring from Tyndale's assistants. And he produced his first complete Bible in English. It was the first Bible to circulate freely in England. The rest of them were underground, and they were persecuted for it. Right after that, in 1537, Thomas Matthew was a pen name for John Rogers, who also was a friend of Tyndale, who also died at the stake under Catholic Queen Mary. It was the first state-authorized Bible in England and the first Bible to use chapter divisions, but not verse divisions. We take those for granted, but the first chapter divisions put in the Bible were put there in 1227 by Stephen Langdon, the Archbishop of Canterbury. Before that, I don't know how they found what place they were referring, but you remember in the New Testament it says somewhere in the prophet Isaiah, they didn't have chapters and verse divisions. And then, as amazing as it may seem, verses weren't put in the Bible until Robert Stephanus put them in his Greek New Testament in 1551. And then it became standard to have both chapter and verse divisions after that time. So the Matthew Bible from Thomas Matthew, a pen name of John Rogers, who was a friend of Tyndale. The Great Bible, the title came from its large size. You could get a hernia from picking up some of those Bibles. If you remember seeing the King James Bible on the end of the table and the cover was wood, it was that thick on both sides. It must have weighed at least 30 pounds or so. The title came from its large size. It was initiated by Thomas Cromwell, who served under Henry VIII. His verses became the basis for the Anglican Book of Common Prayer. If any of you come from an Anglican background, you know that the Book of Common Prayer is the standard fare in the traditional Anglican and Episcopal services. After that, the most significant Bible was the Geneva Bible, which was produced in 1560. This was kind of the Bible of the Reformers, produced in Switzerland under John Knox. It was used by the Puritans, of course, our early fathers. The Pilgrims came on the boat, but shortly after that, the Puritans came. Shakespeare quotes from this Bible. Milton, especially Paradise Lost, his famous classic, quotes from this Bible. It was carried to America on the Mayflower. This is the Bible that was there on the Mayflower when they came across. It divided the text into numbered verses. It's also called the Breeches Bible. And you say, well, why was it called the Breeches or Breeches Bible? Well, because in Genesis 3:7, Adam was said to have sown breeches or leaves together. Now, the original meaning of the word was something that covers your body, especially your back. And so Adam and Eve had sewed fig leaves together, we're told in most translations. And in this Breeches Bible, it translates it by that word. The Bishop's Bible in 1568 was initiated by Queen Elizabeth and carried out under the auspices of the Church of England. It was intended to counteract the Calvinistic biases in the Puritan Geneva Bible, because they were strong Calvinists. Its lasting significance is it was the starting point for the King James Version. The King James translators didn't start from scratch. They started from this Bible, which was basically Tyndale's Bible, and even by the time you get to the King James, it's 80% Tyndale's Bible. Now for the most famous English Bible of all time, still loved by many 400 years later. 400 years later, it's number two on the bestseller in English-speaking countries. It was both literal and literary in its translation, and it'll probably never be excelled. It's probably the most beautiful, the most majestic translation ever produced in English language, and it probably never will have one like it again. Principally because the English language has degenerated, and the beauty of the English language was at its apex. And when you have Shakespeare and Milton and the King James Version of the Bible, and those of us who are reared on this, and I was also, because we didn't have all these translations we're going to talk about next, when I was saved in 1950, and so all the verses I memorized from the King James, and it has a lasting impact and will have for years to come. We're now from 1611, three more years, and that will be 400 years by my calculation. Unfortunately, it's dying of old age. The King James is dying of old age for several reasons. Three. The language is outdated, as we showed last time. We don't talk like we do you to wit, or superfluity of naughtiness, or quit ye like men. We don't talk like that anymore, to say nothing of the these and thous. It was based on an outdated text. There was no early manuscript for the first 500 years of the church used by the King James translators to translate the Bible. They had only later manuscripts because the manuscripts were found roughly from the 1840s to 1900 and following, and so it didn't have the earliest manuscripts. And then an outdated knowledge of the languages by the translators. The modern translators have a better knowledge of the languages than they did, and consequently the King James is dying of old age. And it's mainly the older generation that were reared on it that still cling to it. It sadly needed revision. The King James had lasted till 1881, as you can see, for 270 years. And usually you need a new translation before then. And so the English did the revised version, 1881 to 1885. It was long overdue revision of the King James, but unfortunately it fell stillborn from the press because it was exclusively British project. They tried to involve a few Americans, but they weren't interested, and it lacked the beauty and rhythm of the King James. One of the reasons that people don't memorize the Bible anymore besides that we're lazy and we're computer dependent and all those other things, is that it doesn't have the rhythm and cadence that the King James. King James was easily memorizable, as is the New King James, which I have in my hand. The Revised Version lacked that beauty. It lacked the rhythm. And the Americans, who had to do their own thing in 1901, not liking what the British had done, the American project wasn't any better. It was totally American. Its text was similar to the Revised Version, but was no more successful. And it translated the word Lord, the tetragram, YHWH, by the cumbersome and incorrect Jehovah. Jehovah has the JHVH, or the YHVH, has the four letters, but it borrowed the vowels from the Hebrew word Adonai and put it in the Hebrew word Yahweh, so it's an incorrect translation and should have been translated Yahweh when you put the vowels in there, as of course most scholars today refer to the God of the Old Testament as Yahweh, which is the correct way to transliterate. And the translation turned out to be literal and wooden and not very literary, 1901. About the time the war was over, 1947 to 1957, a English scholar who wrote another great book called Your God is Too Small, J.B. Phillips, did the New Testament. One of my students asked me not too long ago if I knew that Phillips was working on the Old Testament. I said, no, I didn't. He said, yeah, he's going to call it Phillips 66. Not true, but it's funny. This was a pace setting and appetite-whetting paraphrase of the New Testament, paving the way for later paraphrases like today's English version, known as the Good News Bible in the New Testament, or the Living Bible, or the New Living Translation, or the Contemporary English Version, or the more recent, The Message. Now, Phillips' translation broke into the market like a breath of fresh air for King James Version weary readers before there was any RSV or NIV, because we were looking for something fresh, not something stale, not something 300 or more years old. And so people liked it, and it was beautiful. For example, in Hebrews chapter 4, where it says Jesus was tempted in all points like we are, yet apart from sin. That's pretty bland compared to Phillips, who said, we have no superhuman high priest to whom our infirmities are unintelligible. The beauty, the power of that paraphrase was just refreshing to the American and British audiences, and so it caught on, and now we have a whole trail of paraphrase Bibles. The Revised Standard Version came out first in 1946. Now, I started Bible school in 1950, and Moody Bible Institute, Detroit Bible College, where I was, all used the Revised Standard Version, New Testament. It's a good translation. It was up to date. It was literal. It was literary. It was orthodox, and evangelicals embraced it. Until 1952, when they came out with the Old Testament, and they made some very serious mistakes. The most serious being translating Isaiah 7:14. As young maiden rather than virgin, and therefore denying the virgin birth of Christ in the eyes of many. And so the Bible was eventually burned, as I said, in Ohio, and most evangelicals threw it out, New Testament and Old Testament, that they had put together. It has been replaced more recently by the New Revised Standard Version, 1989, which is ecumenical, liberal, gender inclusive, and it's supported by the National Council of Churches. So that hasn't caught on at all in evangelical circles. The New American Standard Version, we were desperate for a translation of our own that wasn't liberal, and so we put together a group of conservative scholars. Resulted from an evangelical desire to have a translation in modern language they could trust. And the result was very accurate, but a very literal rigidly literal study Bible, which lacked the beauty and majesty of the King James Version. People who were scholars loved it. People who wanted something that was very accurate, but people who wanted a pulpit Bible, a Bible you could read in the church, it just didn't have it. The New American Standard of 1971. Then the Living Bible came out. And the Living Bible was, Ken Taylor was riding into Chicago every day on the L there, and he thought he'd spend his time paraphrasing the Bible for his children, and he didn't intend it to begin with for wider circulation, and he did that, and it lacked proper scholarly basis, but was later revised by scholars and called the New Living Translation of the Bible, the NLT, in 1996. During that period, our children were growing up, and we read through the Living Bible 2.5 times, chapter every night for 5 days a week, while our children were growing up, and they learned a lot from it, and it was on their level, and it had great devotional value, as these paraphrases do. Today's English version, the TEV 1976, its New Testament is also known as the Good News for Modern Man, which came out in 1966 in the New Testament version. This is a thoroughgoing outgrowth of Eugene Nida's dynamic equivalent theory. Now, we'll talk about that in a moment. There are two theories of translating the Bible. One's the dynamic equivalent theory, and one's the more literal word-for-word view. It has gender-inclusive language and avoids theological terms like atonement, redemption, righteousness. It's expressed in a very colloquial contemporary American speech. The only thing more colloquial might have been the Cotton Patch version, that's kind of a Georgia country redneck Bible that goes even farther. So the Good News for Modern Man was an attempt to avoid technical terms and to put the Bible in the language of everyday person. Finally, the New International Version came out in 1978. It began with evangelical dissatisfaction with the RSV, which was liberal, perceived to be liberal, especially in the Old Testament. And within a few years after it came out, it had already replaced the King James as the number one selling Bible in the English world. It's weighted on the side of the dynamic equivalent, tends to paraphrase at times. It's not as literal as the King James or the NASB, though it retains the basic orthodox doctrinal orientation of the other Bibles that were produced. One of the abortive attempts of the NIV being so successful in capturing the market, they thought they would go all the way, and they produced today's New International Version in 2006. And it was largely a failure in its attempt to gain widespread evangelical usage because it attempted to become gender-inclusive revision of the NIV. Gratefully, it fell short of applying this gender-inclusive language to God, or they would have come out with phrases like our heavenly parent, instead of our heavenly father, or even our heavenly mother, perish the thought. So it just applied it to human beings, but basically a Southern Baptist boycotted and many other evangelicals, and it fell stillborn off the press because it didn't receive widespread welcome. I knew the whole gender-neutral stuff was going to fail when the feminist movement spawned this, and they decided they wanted to rename manholes, the people holes. I knew that wouldn't work, and the movement was doomed for failure. I certainly don't object to a manhole cover, and if the women insist on having another title, it's not going to get wide acceptance. The New Living Translation of the Bible, 1996, was based on a desire to refute charges that its forerunner, the Living Bible, was unscholarly. It's firmly colloquial and committed to dynamic equivalence, which means paraphrasing the text rather than literally translating it. The English Standard Version 2001. It's an evangelical revision of the RSV. The RSV, when they revised that into the new RSV, they sold the rights to the old RSV, which was a good translation in the New Testament, and was basically good in the Old Testament, except they distorted some messianic prophecies like Isaiah 7:14. So a group of evangelicals bought the rights to the RSV, the old RSV, and they redid it, and they brought it out as the ESV, and it's growing among evangelicals. A number of noted evangelical scholars and pastors have adopted it, and this is the new kid on the block, but it's the growing Bible of people who are not happy with the NIV, thinking it takes too many liberties and paraphrases too much. And it is both a literal and a literary and a conservative translation of the Bible that is definitely worth taking a look at. So that's the history of English translations. Now, behind translations, there's two different theories of translations. One is called the dynamic or functional equivalent, and the other is the formal literal equivalent. And these are quite different theories and come out with a quite different product. For example, the essence of the dynamic equivalent is that you should translate thought for thought. The essence, however, of the formal or literal equivalent is that you should translate word for word, if possible, and sentence for sentence to make sure you're sticking with what the original said. The proper setting for the dynamic equivalent is the audience, the receptor language, where the proper setting for the literal or formal equivalence is the transmitter language. That is, we try to get the reader back into the context of the writer and that culture rather than translate it in terms of the reader's culture. Now, let me illustrate why, would defend the right column here, the formal or literary equivalent view, as opposed to the dynamic or functional view, why that's more defensible. If you carry through the logic of this dynamic equivalent view, that the importance is the receptor language, not the transmitter language, and you have a culture where, let's say, they hate lambs, that sheep are just absolutely repugnant, but they love pigs, then how are you going to translate John 1:29, "Behold the pig of God that takes away the sins of the world"? I don't think so. Because what you want to do is you want to get the people in the receptor language into the context where they can understand the transmitter language, because that's where the real meaning comes. It's the author's meaning in his culture, in his context, with his words, and the reader should be brought into that context to understand it, rather than paraphrasing it and taking away the rich imagery of a lamb in the Bible. Think of all the lamb sacrifices and the Day of Atonement and Christ, our Passover lamb, and all of the rich images that you lose if you translated into the receptor's culture. In a dynamic equivalent, interpretation is the maximal possible. In other words, it's not really so much a translation as it is an interpretation. Now, granted, you have to interpret some in order to translate. That's not the point. They use the maximal amount of interpretation, whereas in the literal, formal equivalent view, they use the minimal amount of interpretation necessary to get it across. It's not thematic interpretation, it's linguistic interpretation. As to the relationship between form and content, the dynamic equivalent thinks that you can separate these two, whereas the literal says you can't separate it. It must be understood in its own culture. This is why it's called the historical grammatical means of interpretation. You got to get into that history, to that grammar, to that culture in order to understand it. The meaning versus words, dynamic equivalent, just think of that as paraphrase versus literal translation. Meaning is expressed without words. Thought can be known apart from words. Whereas the literal interpretation, people say, there is no meaning expressed without words. Thought is known by words. And the locus of meaning is not to be found in the mind of the author. I don't have any way to get the author's mind. I'm not a psychologist, and he's not here. All I know is what the author expressed. It's the thought known by words, not in his mind, but is in his text. The meaning, the matching of ideas only for the interpretive view, and ideas in words and word classes are supposed to be matched. Meaning and significance, what's the difference? Meaning is what and significance is how. Meaning is what the text says, its message, and significance is how it's applied to someone's life. And the dynamic equivalent people think that a translation is supposed to do both. The literal interpretation people say, no, a translation is only supposed to get the meaning across. Leave the application up to the individual, to the pastor, to the teacher, but you just translate. The goal of the dynamic equivalent is to reproduce the same effect the Bible had in the lives of the people in the first century, to reproduce it in the people to whom the Bible speaks in this day. Whereas a literal interpretation, people say, no, our job as translators is only to produce the same meaning, not to produce the same effect. Our goal is not pragmatic, is to get the truth across. The focus of the dynamic equivalent is the response to the message. How did the people respond to the message? Whereas the focus in the literal interpretation is what's the form of the message? Did we lose the message in the process of translating it? Now, examples of the dynamic equivalent would be the NIV and all the paraphrases that we talked about, from Phillips' paraphrase right on up to the Message. Where examples of the formal, more literal interpretation would be the King James, the New King James, New American Standard Bible, and the Evangelical Standard Version. I go through that because if you don't understand that there's a deep philosophical debate going on beneath translation, you can't translate if you don't have a theory of translation. Even if you don't know what the theory is, you're using one unwittingly. And if you want a Bible that is paraphrased, that's interpretive, that's trying to make application to you, then you want to buy the Message and the Living Bible and the NIV. If, on the other hand, you want to understand the meaning of the original text, you want to buy a Bible like the King James, the New King James, the NASB, or the ESV. Reasons against the dynamic equivalent, and I'm just now kind of summarizing the chart and arguing for why we ought to make literal translations of the Bible, not paraphrase. Number one, the dynamic equivalent wrongly tries to translate significance, how it applies, and not just meaning, what it means. That's not the translator's job. That's the pastor's job, the teacher's job, the individual reader's job. The translator is supposed to translate the meaning, not the significance. Two, it makes interpretive decisions for the readers and runs the risk of being wrong. Now, that's a good way to put it, but my first observation as I, read through the NIV and as I used it like most other people did, and I was gaining a growing dissatisfaction with it, and I suddenly concluded what it was. They were interpreting for me. Rather than leaving the ambiguity open, which the original left there, they were interpreting it without telling me they had interpreted it. A good example of that would be in Hebrews 12, which the today's new NIV does, it says, fathers discipline their children. And so they translate that parents. Why? They're trying to apply it. They don't want to leave mothers out. And so they use the word parent. The original doesn't say parent. It says father, and for a good reason. Father's the head of the home, and he's the one responsible, ultimately, for the discipline in the home. And to translate it parents is to miss the meaning of the original. in the attempt to apply the Bible, the significance, it loses the actual meaning. And sometimes it has significant doctrinal difference when it does that. Three, it wrongly requires translators to resolve ambiguities for the reader. If the original text leaves the ambiguity there, the ambiguity should be translated so that the reader knows that there was an ambiguity there, and he can compare Scripture with Scripture and decide for himself. But what happens in the NIV is they take care of the ambiguity for you. And sometimes they're wrong. And so you're reading it as though it were a translation and is really an interpretation where they made the decision for you. Number four, it wrongly assumes that form is simply a vehicle to get the content or message across to the recipient. It's not true. There is no bifurcation between form and content. They come as one package. And therefore, you have to understand the message in its milieu before you attempt to translate that into a new milieu. Number five, it wrongly encourages the translator to interpret images and figures for the reader. If you do that, and your reader, as I said before, loves pigs and hates lambs, you're going to be in deep trouble. How are you going to handle the rich imagery of the Lamb of God in Scripture if you don't say, look, in that culture they love lambs, they love sheep, and this is why, because a sheep is innocent, because a sheep is this, that, and the other thing, and get them to understand it in its original context. Six, it often leads to the loss of important repetitions and emphases in the text. If you start doing that interpretation, you don't see that in the original text there were some emphases, if you translate it literally, that would come out, but if you don't, they don't come out. Seven, it wrongly assumes that meaning can best be understood in the context of the receptor language. It can't. The meaning of what the author meant cannot best be understood in the context of what somebody else is living. It wrongly assumes that form content are separable dualities. They are not. It wrongly assumes that meaning can be known without words. It cannot. The meaning is expressed in words. It wrongly assumes that the author's thought can be known without the text. How in the world would you know the author's thought? Read between the lines, behind the lines, beyond the lines, get a psychologist to analyze the author. The author's not here. You only know what the author meant by what he said. And what he said is in the text. It's not in the author's mind behind the text. It wrongly assumes that the locus of meaning is in the author's mind rather than the text. If that's so, then we'll never be able to get it because we can't get into his mind. We can only get into his expressions. 12, it wrongly supposes its goal is to reproduce the same effect rather than the same meaning. Who said so? Who said that the whole purpose was to convey effect? That's a pragmatic view. God's interested in truth. He wants to convey the meaning and the truth of the passage. 13, it wrongly focuses on the response of the message rather than on the form of the message. Well, you can respond differently to different things at different times, but the whole point is, if you want to convey the truth of the original to us today in our language, you're not concerned about the response to it, you're concerned about the form to it. Now, there's a professor at Wheaton College, usually the people who defend the correct view are in the literature departments, and the people in the Bible departments have gone hog wild with Eugene Nida and the dynamic equivalent view. And this professor Reichen wrote a book called The Word of God in English. It's well worth reading. And here's what he said. These are accepted rules for published texts. The author's own words matter. It matters what the exact words were in the original text, and it's the translator's obligation to translate those words word for word as much as possible, and certainly sentence for sentence. Publishers and editors are not ordinarily allowed to change the words of literary texts. That's not part of the ethics. You're supposed to keep the words of the original source. Readers expect to receive the actual words of the author. I want to know what he said. And I expect if somebody's translating it for me that he'll give me the words of the author. 4. Readers need to be educated in the meaning of difficult texts. You say, well, we don't know what that word means. Well, that's what dictionaries are for. If you don't know what the word means, look it up in the dictionary. Figurative language is not changed, but is explained in the notes. Explained in the notes. It's a figure of speech. Explained to them, translated fairly, explained it's a figure of speech. 6. Authors expect their own words to be unaltered by publishers. If there's anything I hate as an author is for some frustrated author who couldn't write his own book, and he got a job as an editor and he decided to write his own book on mine. And he just changes it and I get it back and I can't figure out what happened. That's not an editor's job. The editor's job is to correct errors that the author made, to take care of errata and punctuation and spelling and things like that. We expect our own words to be unaltered. Note, why should not the Bible be treated with the same respect? Professor Reichen asks. And the NIV doesn't do that. None of the paraphrases do that. Only the New American Standard Bible and the Evangelical Revised Version and the New King James do that to the King James and those like that. I turn now to the third point, the criteria of a good translation. What is it that makes a good translation? Well, it's got to be accurate. It has to be clear. If it's not clear and accurate, then you don't know what the original said. It should be vivid. It should be something that is lively. Hanging around people like J.I. Packer really enlightened me. We were on the committee together of the ICBI, the International Council of Biblical Inerrancy. We spent 10 years together. And we'd have these conferences, and we'd have committees dealing with different things, and they would come back with a little paragraph. We were going to end up the conference with a statement. The famous Chicago Statement on Inerrancy, 1978, came from that. J.I. Packer was on the committee, and it was soon obvious to the rest of us, like R.C. Sproul and John Gerstner and James Boyce people like that, soon obvious that the best person for writing this final product was J.I. Packer. They could come with a paragraph that long, and J.I. Packer could shrink that baby to that size without changing the meaning at all. And one of the ways he did it is illustrated by the following. If I said to you, John came in the room and he walked rapidly to the other side. Well, that's a pretty cumbersome statement. J.I. Packer taught me that you don't need these long descriptive things. You don't need clauses. You don't need adjectival descriptions and adjectival phrases. You can do it with a verb, a very powerful verb. John burst into the room. And that's not only accurate and clear, but it's vivid. You can just see him moving rapidly across the room. You don't have to say that. You say he burst into the room. The translation also should be orthodox. The RSV didn't do that. The Revised Standard RSV didn't do it. It's not a young maiden. It's a virgin that conceived. And Isaiah, or rather Psalm 45, says, "Thy throne, O God." It's not the throne of the divine and so forth and so on. A good translation preserves the ambiguities of the original. So you know that that was not clear from the original and you can make the choice. It's transparent to the original. It serves as kind of the better translation is like a glass that helps you see the original without knowing the language. It expects the best from its readers. It expects its readers to be able to look up words they don't understand, to put themselves in this context of the first century so they can understand it. It retains the poetic form of the original. So that's where a lot of translations really fail. When it comes to the Psalms, and Hebrew poetry is in dualisms, when it comes to the Psalms, most other translations other than maybe the New King James and the Evangelical Revised Version lose the whole cadence and rhythm there. It doesn't keep the poetic form of the original. And, of course, It needs to have beauty and dignity. That's what was wrong with the NASB. It was literal, but it was wooden. It wasn't usable for the pulpit. It didn't have the dignity and beauty that it should have. And these are all adopted from Professor Leland Ryken's book, The Word of God in English, in the conclusion. All right, we have reached the point of conclusion. Let's apply this. Some conclusions. Dynamic equivalent Bibles are not good translations, like the NIV. You say, well, I like it. That's fine, read it if you like it. It's not a good translation. It attempts to do all of those things that we said are wrong, and in so doing, it often distorts the original. Let me give you an example from Acts chapter 2, verses 30 and 31. Peter is talking about the resurrection. He's quoting Psalm 16. And he uses the Greek word sarx, flesh, of the resurrection body. That's a strong word. Luke 24:39 uses it. I have flesh and bones. I'm not a spirit. Sarx. The Greek word for body is soma. And so the translators of the NIV, trying to put themselves, trying to feel their way through, give you the significance, put themselves in the context of the receptor, decided that they were going to translate the word sarx by the word body. And it says in the NIV, body there, when it should be the Greek word sarx, it should have translated flesh. In fact, the Apostles' Creed, up to and through the Reformation, read, I believe in the resurrection of the flesh. Because the people who wrote the creed were trying to squelch the Gnostic-like views, and we have it today in New Orthodoxy and other views, that minimize the resurrection and turn the resurrection body into a spiritual body rather than a literal physical body. So I know most of the people on the NIV committee. I know the guy who's in charge of it, and so I wrote a note to him, and I said, look, you translated flesh in Luke 24 of the resurrection body. Why did you translate it body here, which is a weaker word? And frankly, I've read the answer to my question several times. It makes no sense. If you boil it down, it's, well, we just felt it was better. That's the problem with the dynamic equivalent view. It's very subjective. Secondly, paraphrases are not good translations. The CEV, the NLT, the Message, the Good News Bible. You say, well, I get blessings out of them. Well, they read it and get a blessing out of it. We read through the Living Bible 2.5 times, as I said, and got a lot of blessings. That's not the point. Also read Streams in the Desert. Also read My Utmost for His Highest. I also read Daily Bread and get blessings out of all of those. But they don't pretend to be a translation of the Bible. They pretend to be what they are, a devotional guide. And devotional guides are good. But I don't want somebody mixing his interpretive devotional guide with the Bible. I want my Bible straight. I don't want it diluted by anyone else's devotional interpretation. Good translations are literal translations, like the NASB and the Net Bible. I haven't said anything about it, but there's another good literal translation out there with good scholarly notes known as the Net Bible, done largely by Dallas Seminary teachers. And that's a good literal translation as well. Good translations are also literary translations. NASB and the NET are not literary. They're literal, but they're not literary. They don't have rhythm, cadence, beauty, majesty. The King James will never, ever be excelled in terms of majesty and dignity. You can say what you want, that these and thous have become obsolete, but it gives a certain reverence to talking to God. And a lot of times in prayer, I just naturally slip into that because it's more beautiful. And my mind was trained in it. The NASB, in my opinion, is still the best study Bible. If you're not into literary and majesty and all of that, and you just want to have it straight, a good literal translation, you cannot beat the NASB. It's done by Orthodox translators. It's word for word as much as possible, or sentence for sentence. and the best literal and literary and orthodox translations are the New King James Version and the Evangelical Standard Version, the new one that was the revision of the RSV. Those two retain the literary dignity and majesty along with being word-for-word translations for your study. You might want to get an NASB, and for your usage in the public, in the pulpit, and the teaching, I use the New King James Version, though I see that more and more people are getting interested in the ESV, and I could hope that it will succeed and will become a very successful Bible at that.